Get lucky they won't.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tell me they're not going to play it. Don't do that. Where did that come from? Who is that? Huh? Okay, I have no idea what song that is. I think it was supposed to be Embraceable You, but it doesn't sound like it. But anyway, it's over. And next time it probably won't be there. Hello, everybody. This is Fran Lewis, your host from snowy New York State, filled with 12 inches of snow outside and ice, but the sun is shining. So we have a very powerful show today. We have the author of Devil in the Hole, Charles Salzberg, that's going to talk about very interesting murders that took place in 1971. And then we have Carol Esposar, The Unvarnished Truth About the Prison Family Journey. And before I say hello to my guest, and this is going to be really very intense and very interesting, I would like to thank the people at Hamilton Lanes for the great experience I have. For those of you that have ever been Trenton, New Jersey and like to bowl, please join Manager Keith at 1200 Coosa Road. And if you are an author and would like your book reviewed by me and an online interview and you go to Hamilton Lanes and tell Keith that Fran from Blog Talk sent you, I'll review your book and I'll do an online interview for you. So, let's start. I would like to greet the author of Devil in a Hole. This book is really quite chilling, and it's fantastic. And if I could have given it 10 stars, I would have, Charles Salzberg. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Hi, Fran. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you. Finally, we got to connect. This is so cool. So tell me, this is a very powerful story. Why did you decide that you needed to write this and let everybody know about this particular these particular murders?
Well, when I first learned about the murders, I was a very young magazine journalist, and I read this story in the front page of the New York Times about this murder, horrendous murder in New Jersey of a family, an entire family that was murdered. It was a woman and her three children and her mother-in-law and the family dog, and the husband's father had disappeared. And he was presumed to be the one who committed the murders. But it was a very interesting situation because he had planned the murders out very well, so well that he gave himself a three-week head start before the murders, the bodies were discovered. And so I thought this would make a great true crime first magazine article and then a true crime book. But everywhere I tried to pitch it, they said, well, you can't do this story because the murderer hasn't been caught, and there's no end to the story. And so what started out as the idea of doing it as a true crime story, years passed, and he was never found. And the story stayed with me, not because of the crime itself, but I was trying to understand how someone could do such a horrible thing, murder your entire family and the family dog, and plan it out. I could understand someone snapping and just doing something like that. But that haunted me. And when I couldn't write a true crime story, I started to think of it as a novel and tried to figure out how I could write it as a novel so that I could figure out how and why someone could do something like that. So that's the genesis of the book.
Yeah, it's hard to get inside the mind of a diabolical killer. It's almost as if he was writing a plot for a book. And he just reenacted it by the way he wrote it in each chapter. It's almost as if this guy was, like you said, planned it for 3 weeks, and then he reenacted his little plot or his book in real life. That is scary.
It was very scary.
It is. So in this book, you have the neighbor, and his name was James Kirkland. And why didn't anybody realize that something happened in this particular house in the book? It took them forever to realize that something was going on. And why was this man so bent on finding out?
Okay, good questions. Well, first of all, it was the murderer was extremely clever. And this part that I'm going to tell you now really did happen. The book is a novel, but I just, right after the crime itself, everything else is made up. So James Kirkland is made up as a character, but it's true that this is how the murders were uncovered. What the murderer did was he alerted the school that his kids wouldn't be in school for a number of weeks because they'd be visiting relatives in North Carolina, I think. He stopped the newspapers. He stopped the mail. And what he did is after he committed the murders, he turned on every light in the house so it would appear as if people were in the house. And in real life, this is what happened. A neighbor across the street started noticing that all the lights were on, burning all night, and that the only time a light would go off, it would never come back on. So a room would suddenly go dark, and he would notice that that the light would never go on in that room. And so finally, he got suspicious enough to call the police. And so what I did was I created a character named James Kirkland, who is the neighbor, who does get fascinated by this, what's going on across the street. He has no idea what it is, but he gets obsessed every night with looking out his window and checking to see what lights are on and what lights are off. And finally, in the novel, as very much it happened in real life, he gets so curious and so worried that he calls the police. And that's the way I have it in the novel, and that's pretty much the way it happened in real life.
What would have happened, do you think, if he had called sooner? Do you think anybody would have been alive?
No. I think that the murders were, as I said, well-planned. And the time lapse between the murders and finding it, the murderer couldn't have planned about how long he would have, but he knew by the setup, by stopping the mail and stopping calling the school and all that, that no one would inquire about the family. And he was probably hoping that maybe for a week or a few days or he would throw people off the track. And he got as much as 3 weeks in real life. And at that point, when the police found the murders, they then they found his car abandoned at, I believe, Kennedy Airport. So at that point, they knew that he had left the state, left the area.
That is so chilling. Because you would think that, I know as an educator that if students are absent more than 3-4 days, they want to know why. And 3 weeks, definitely, a guidance counselor that does their job, if you can find one, but, you know, if they're doing their job the right way, is going to call the house and find out why. Unless it's a family death or an emergency that he made up, they should get suspicious. That's scary.
That's exactly what fascinated me is the planning that had gone into that to alert the school. Look, you know, the kids are going to be out of school for several weeks because we're going as a family emergency or something.
Yeah, he had to make up something really good because usually they wouldn't. And normally if they would say, well, then they have to get all their work before they go so that they have their assignments beforehand. It's bone chilling. But one was doing their homework, and another one was in the other room, and the boy was sleeping, right? Oh, my God. So what happened when the police finally got there? The reaction of the officers must have been horrible.
Yeah. Well, again, once I set up the case, everything else is made up. So I did some research on it, but I didn't want to do too much research because I wanted to invent the characters. So in the book, what happens is two cops come to the house, and they try to rouse someone by ringing the doorbell and knocking on the door, and no one answers. And then they finally break into the house, and they find the bodies lined up one next to another, each one on a blanket, each one shot to death. In a house that's almost empty of furniture. And that part is true. Again, I don't know who the cops were in real life. I invented two cops who got there.
Yeah, you did.
But that is how the bodies were discovered.
It's almost as if it was a movie scene or a portrait or a portrait that, or an artist painting that he was trying to create a picture, because each one was the same. That's what's even scarier. And there was,
And placed in a kind of loving way, you know, lying on a blanket, one next to the other, as if they were a family, which they were.
Well, they were, but he sort of divorced himself from the thought that they were anybody after a while. My thought was, you know, he did that just to prove what, that he cared about them, at least, you know, to give them dignity or something, because he really didn't care about them. It's almost as if when he left, he just wiped them from his mind. That they weren't even, it was like he wiped them from his mind that he did, that they weren't even there anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, it's scary. So Schuster and Stiles were the two officers. And
right,
what research did you do about handling a police case?
What did I know about it? How did you know how
the police would handle a crime scene, not to contaminate certain things, or in these cases, these officers not to pass out from what they saw?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting you should ask that, Fran, because I think today, with all the TV shows and movies, that we all know so much about police procedure, or at least we think we do, and from books, that it's not so hard to imagine what could happen. Again, a novelist can take certain has certain latitude to do things, but we do know so much. I mean, you could write a crime novel and talk about how not to contaminate a crime scene. You know, we've watched.
I think maybe at this point you're right.
Yeah, I mean, we've watched the O.J. Simpson courtroom case and all that stuff, and we know more than we think we know.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But, you know, there are a lot of authors that have written, you know, novels or whatever, and sometimes I wonder, like, the facts make no sense, or some of the way that they handled it. Oh, the policeman walked in and he accidentally stepped on whatever. No, a real policeman is not going to contaminate anything. He might, you know, you don't know. Or, you know, somebody came into the house and got scared. Yeah, they're not going to do the right thing, but the police would. I mean, it's a scary thing. But why did this neighbor, why did he want to get involved so much? He, you know, after a while he was like, there the whole time, this James Kirkland. What about this fascinated him so much that he wanted to make sure that the press knew he was there? And why did he wanted to tell him about his murders? And his wife wasn't too thrilled. She just wanted to not know anything. She wanted to move, I think.
Right. Well, for me, what this character that I invented is he's leading a pretty boring life. You know, it's very humdrum. You know, nothing ever happens in his life. And here this thing happens across the street. And I think that that a person like him would just get obsessed with it and kind of want to own the case. In other words, he became more important suddenly in his life, in his town, with his family, because he was part of this big story. And that's the kind of character I was trying to get at, someone who lives vicariously through other people. And so he does the nosy neighbor.
Yeah, he became an obnoxious nosy neighbor after a while.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But each chapter reflects the voice of somebody else, another character, a different person that supposedly was close to this murderer and didn't know what he was really like, or was suspicious but didn't really see it. So each chapter reflects the thoughts and actions. Why did you decide to present the fact in the voices of those who were involved and knew the killer? Did that make the crime a little bit more real, or so that we understood the killer a little bit better, or what he was like before he decided to kill all these people?
Two reasons. One was a very practical, technical reason, and that goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that originally, when I first conceived of this novel, I was a magazine journalist and had written a lot of magazine articles. And I wanted to do it as a true crime book. And I thought, well, if I did it that way, if I'd done it that way, I would have been the interviewer. I would have found all these people and interviewed them. And I thought, well, this is an interesting way to do a novel, too. I can build the whole novel through the voices and eyes of other people, because when someone gets murdered, it's really not just that person who gets murdered. The murder affects so many people around that person, whether it be the family or friends or people in the town that they live. And I thought, well, this is an interesting way to get at the ramifications of murder or any crime, really. It doesn't just affect the person involved. It affects all these other people. And a lot of the other thing, the image that kept going through my head is whenever you see these news programs and someone's been murdered and it's, you know, they find people who live around the murderer and they interview them and they always say, oh, he was such a nice young boy, you know, he was so polite. And I thought, well, you know, that is the way people see some people, but that's not always the way they are. So I thought, well, I'm going to do that too. I'm going to create a world where we see all these people around the murderer and around the murdered people and find out what they think. And also, because most of the book takes place following the escape route of the murderer, I thought, well, it would be really interesting to get the point of view of people that he meets along his escape route and see how he acts and interacts with them. And that will let the reader know kind of what's going on in his mind and how he's relating to other people. So that's why I chose to do it that way.
Yeah, he justifies himself. We'll come to that after. He justifies himself. He even says that he's no longer the person he was. He's somebody else living somewhere else. So whatever he did before, he really didn't do. Which
that's
is
right.
Really,
I mean, my idea.
Right. It's scary.
Because my concept of why he did it had to do with erasing and starting over again.
Yeah.
And how many of us haven't thought at some point, oh, wow, gee, I wish I could just erase my whole life and start completely new. And so if that is going to be that kind of motivation, then he would have to think, oh, I'm not that person anymore. I'm a new person. That person is behind me.
That's scary because people, you know, that he met, some of them thought he was normal and some of them didn't. Now, the police chief was really glad that the FBI took over. He didn't want to deal with this, so how come, and who is Charles Floyd? And he was relentless, this guy. I really liked him. He wasn't giving up.
No. Okay, the police chief is, in my mind, was someone who was nearing retirement, just wanted no problems. He just wanted to leave the stage, you know, go fishing somewhere, retire, and here this big case is thrown into his lap, at least in the beginning, and it's the last thing in the world he wanted. I mean, it's as if think of yourself if you're ready to retire from your job and you've got 2 days left and someone dumps a pile of work on your desk. I mean, it's the last thing you want. I mean, it's kind of like a kid in school. You know about this, friend. I mean, the last thing that kid wants is homework assignments in June. You know, their eyes are toward the summer vacation. And so that's why he wants to just, he's so glad when someone else takes on the case. And as far as Charles Floyd, who is the investigator, he has probably the most chapters in the book, his point of view.
Yeah, I liked him. He was really good. He was interesting.
Well, thanks. He is someone who is kind of cocky. He thinks of himself as a superstar. Think of an athlete. And this is a challenge to him. This case is a challenge to him, and he begins to take it personally. And he sort of his relentlessness in trying to catch the murderer has to do with his vision of himself as being successful. And the more he doesn't succeed, the more relentless he gets, because he becomes defined by finding this murderer. So they're really two sides of the same coin, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'll tell you something. Now that you said that, it almost sounds like the nosy neighbor and the police and this Charles Floyd had something to prove, that they both wanted to feel important. He wanted to be part of the investigation. He wanted to close the investigation and get the killer.
Right. But don't you think that's true of everyone? Fran, don't we all want to be important or feel important? And so that's the universality of it, I think, is that we all want to stand out in some way. And, you know, a lot of us don't have the way to do that. And I think that's very perceptive of you to say that, is that you know, at base we all have a lot of commonalities, but we don't go out and kill people, you know, and we don't go out and chase murderers either.
Well, that's why I do book reviews. I think the nicest thing that ever happens is if somebody emails me back and says, I love what you wrote, or that is a great review, you understood my book. And that's better than anything, because I don't expect that. I guess you're right. Everybody wants to be accepted or, you know, appreciated for something. And since I don't get paid to do book reviews in Amazon, I don't get paid to do them, the nicest thing someone could say is, oh, I love what you wrote and you showcased my book. So you're right.
Mm-hmm.
This
and
case,
I'll tell you this.
Go on.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, as someone who writes and has reviewed books for years, I used to review books for the New York Times, I would second what you say. The best thing that a reviewer can say about me is not that your book was terrific, but that they understood what I was trying to get at. And so that's because you work so hard on a book and you have a vision of what you're trying to say. And it's not about just someone liking it, but it's someone understanding it really makes you feel better.
You're so right. And I have been really, somebody said it to me that I haven't missed one. It's scary. sometimes it takes a little bit longer. But I will tell you that there hasn't been a book that I haven't gotten what the author said. But I'll be honest, if the book doesn't get 4 stars, I won't review it. I'll just summarize it. Because I don't think it's my job to pan somebody's writing that they work so hard on. I might not think it's the greatest book in the world, but somebody else may give it 5 stars. So I would rather summarize it, and I won't post it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, so it doesn't get any stars, but it will get, you know, out there. And usually they sell it anyway. I don't know. So the Hartman case, we call him John Hartman in this, was quite complicated. Who helped Floyd? And on page 34, on this page you described the murderer and something odd about the scene. What was it? And I have the book in front of me.
About the scene of the murders, you mean? One of the odd things was that there were bullet holes in the house, in the walls. And what the investigators are trying to figure out is why were there bullet holes? And to me, what it meant was that he was not only killing his family, he was killing a lifestyle. He was deeply in debt. There was a mortgage on the house. That was part of his wanting to erase his life, is the idea that he was a failure. And so they found, there were no pictures of him in the house. He had torn off his picture from the frames of the family pictures, and there were these bullet holes in the walls. And it wasn't because he was chasing the family around and trying to shoot them. I believed it had to do with anger and frustration about this house that he couldn't afford.
Yeah, I'm looking at page 35, and it said there were 3 separate mortgages, one for $120,000, one for $90,000, and one recently taken out for $75,000, and the house was $500,000 when he bought it. And they asked questions like, did he play the horses drink or was he on drugs? And they didn't know that yet. He was 48 years old when he did this, according to this, right? And they had no pictures. It's scary that he made himself so invisible. Even though he was really visible, he made himself totally invisible. So if someone were to analyze this man, what would they say? He was a psychopathic killer or just he wasn't schizophrenic. But how would you describe him?
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think that he was probably closest to a sociopath.
That's
who just he had rationalized what he was doing. Now, it's interesting, Fran, because in real life, 18 years after the murder, America's Most Wanted did a program about this case. The real name of the fellow was John List. And sure enough, they had aged a photograph of him, and sure enough, someone recognized him. And he was living a whole other life. He had remarried. He was living. He had a job, I believe, in Denver, Colorado, or somewhere out there. Mm-hmm. And they found him. They arrested him. They convicted him. And I believe he died in prison about 3 years ago. But the real reason, real life, why he did it was he was a very religious man, and he believed that his family was straying from the path of righteousness.
Really?
Yes, and he was going to, before they would go to hell, he was going to murder them so that he could meet them in heaven, because if he killed them before they transgressed any further, they would still go to heaven. So in real life, I don't know what you would call that, whether you would call that a psychopath or a sociopath or a schizophrenic, I don't know. But whatever it was, 18 years after the actual murders, this man was able to function in society and, to our knowledge, never killed anyone else. But in my book, it's a different reason why he kills them.
Yeah.
And I would say that he's probably closer to a sociopath and certainly not a schizophrenic. He's not that at all. I mean, he's a bright man who feels things very deeply and is obviously terribly misguided. And might have a psychopathic moment, but he's not a psychopath.
No. Reverend Chapman befriended him. What was their relationship, and why did they become so friendly?
I think the relationship was twofold. One, Chapman, the Reverend, is trying to do his job and save everyone. And he's kind of fascinated by this John Hartman, who is new in the neighborhood, has just newly moved into this community, and so he wants to try to get him into the fold. As far as Hartman is concerned, I think that he's truly looking for answers, and he's looking for answers. He's very skeptical about religion, about God, about the presence of God. I mean, how could man in the world if there is a God? And so he befriends the Reverend, because he really is looking for answers. He's looking for some kind of, he's not a religious man. I think that he's looking for some kind of answer that will solve his problems and make things right so that he doesn't have to do the kind of deed that he does. But he never gets those answers.
No, he doesn't. So what did the Reverend think about Hartman's wife and his family? What was his impression?
I think he felt a little sorry for them. I think that he was, trying to help them. The family in the book, and I think to a certain extent in real life, was very reclusive. The woman was didn't go out and make friends in the neighborhood, in the community. And I think that the Reverend's job was to try to bring them into the society, and they were a challenge to him.
It's almost as if the Reverend saw something that maybe that no one else did, but this man was definitely abusive, maybe not physically, but he was definitely abusive in some other ways. I mean,
yes.
When you described how the children came out of the house, whatever, and they were so, almost as if they were shaking, they didn't want to go into a car with him, they didn't want to be with him. They seemed as if they were terrified of this man. And the fact that the wife never did anything is scary. I mean, but there are a lot of people out there that are, husbands abuse them, which is wrong, and they're all afraid about what's going to happen if they say anything. That's even
worse. I think that's very common, don't you? I mean, it's very common.
I've dealt with that in schools where, parents of child abuse and fathers that have come in, and you could see that the wife was abused, and I'm the kind of person that if I saw, if I even guessed, if I had an inkling, I reported it, and I wasn't sorry because unfortunately I was never wrong. And you don't know whose life you're going to save that when you do that. So, I mean, to report child abuse or wife abuse or spousal abuse, you have to. And as an educator, you are mandated to. So if I saw, even the school, I can't believe the school didn't notice that these kids were so afraid. You know, if a child is, outgoing and they get quiet, there's a problem. or if a child is quiet and all of a sudden becomes a discipline problem, there's a problem. You can tell behavior changes, and you can almost guess that when something is happening. So describe, who was Janine McClellan, and what was her relationship with the killer?
Well,
she
was
a lot of relationships, this guy.
Right. She was his mistress. And to me, she represented for him the outside world and a world that he didn't have with his family and a world that he aspired to, where he could be a new person and have another life. And so she, you know, who and had nothing to do with the murders and is shocked that he was capable of something like that, she was his portal to the outside world. And that's the relationship that why he was in a relationship with her. Why is any woman in relationship with a married man? We, you know, there are so many reasons. It's so, you know, it's so difficult to pin down one reason. But in my mind, that's what she represented to him was an escape, you know.
How did his sister describe him? The girl that in the book that described him.
Well, I think, yeah, the sister, I think that every, you know, no one, there are always signs of someone who's a troubled person.
Yes.
And I think the sister who grew up with him did see signs of him being troubled, of him being, you know, lonely and a little disturbed, you know, and she talks about that kind of stuff, you know, how he, what his fantasies were and how he was, you know, with little pieces of paper. I mean, very, very controlled. Often the most dangerous people are the people who are who try the hardest to control themselves, because they ultimately explode, and that's what kind of happened to him. And I think that she, on retrospect and looking back on his behavior, is not totally surprised that he cracked. And did something. No one can imagine that someone can do something as horrible as that, especially a relative. But I think that she saw signs that he was, you know, emotionally fragile as a child.
Well, James Kirkland doesn't let up, does he? So what does he do? What does Hartman do to change everything, let everyone know that he's not done yet? Because they think he's gone, but he comes back and does one more thing.
Well, that's the interesting, Fran. The reader's not supposed to know necessarily for sure what happens. What were you referring to is that the house burns down.
Yeah,
the house,
cool.
1 year after the crime, the house mysteriously burns down.
Yeah.
And, of course, everyone in the town thinks that Hartman has come back and burned the house.
Yeah.
I wanted to keep that a mystery. I didn't want to say whether or not it was true, because it was more important to me as the author that people in the town thought it was true. In other words, that his effect was so strong on that town that even a year afterwards, as unlikely as it might be that he would come back just to burn the house down, that people believe that that's exactly what happened. And in real life, by the way, that house did burn down.
Wow.
And it burned down furiously, and probably it was burned down by vandals in real life. They never found out why. But that was the other fact of the case that I did use. But I wanted it to be a mystery. I wanted it to be uncertain. I wanted the reader to try to think of, well, is it possible Hartman came back and burned it, or did something else happen?
Did they ever rebuild a house there?
No. Well, someone bought the property, as I understand, and there is a house there. The actual case happened in Westfield, New Jersey, and there is a house there. But you know, it wasn't. I'm sure they used a different style and all that kind of stuff.
So somebody is actually saying, I live on the same property as this person, that I wouldn't exactly want to say that. That's scary.
Yeah, no.
I don't know if I'd want to say I lived in the same house as that, you know, same style, you know, same area or whatever. And knowing that he's gone, well, okay, that might be okay, but still, I don't think I'd want to live on the same property or in the same area as this
man. Me neither.
No, I don't think so. What was it about the Reverend that he kept wanting to connect with him? He kept showing up.
I think, you know, again, it has to do with the themes of success. I think that the Reverend wanted to have a success. The Reverend wanted mm-hmm. this man who was was very close to being a non-believer in God. The Reverend wanted to have the power or the ability to take this man and convince him that there was a God and that he should come to church or follow the teachings of the church. And so he was a challenge. I mean, I believe that everyone is challenged in life, mm-hmm. you know, and wants to be successful. And so it all reverberates about that theme of failure. So mm-hmm. if he could turn John Hartman around and make him a believer in God again and make him a part of the community, successful and part mm-hmm. of the community, then he was doing his job and he would be success. And so, remember, we talked about the investigator, Floyd. They all yeah. have jobs to do and they all want to be successful. But Hartman, in a way, is thwarting that success by A, what he did, and B, escaping, and C, not finding God. And so there are a lot of these themes I wanted to reverberate like that.
And they did. And they were bone-chilling.
Okay.
And just listening to his voice, I got the chills. I mean, I read the synopsis when they sent it to me, but I wasn't really sure what I was reading. And as I started to read it, well, there are two kinds of books. The kind that I could read in an hour and a half, and that's called zap time, and it's really good. Then I go back over it and write my review, my questions. And then there's the kind that take more than one day. That's no good. And this one took me less than 2 hours, and I'm saying I couldn't put it down. Once I started it,
yeah, I mean,
oh, my God, I can't put it down.
I have to tell you, as an author, that's the kindest, nicest thing you can say, because someone else said to me, the other nice thing is I didn't want it to end. And those
yeah.
are the two that writers want to hear, you know.
I was waiting to see what he did. The ending was really startling. So people, if you think he told you what really happened, no, he didn't. The ending was startling. And I'm saying, okay, is he going to write a sequel? Are we bringing this guy back? You know what? You have a great character with Charles Floyd. What?
Yeah, well, it's so funny you should say that. And I think you were hinting at it. I had no idea of doing anything like that. And a friend of mine said, you know, if I were you, I would consider writing a sequel to this book using Charles
yeah.
Floyd, the mm-hmm. investigator, and the Cuban detective. He goes down to Florida
yeah.
to follow, you know, leads, and he meets this Cuban detective. And you know
right.
something? That might be a good idea. What do you think? I mean, they might make two interesting characters for a book.
That's what I was thinking. they would, because they're so opposite, and yet they're both really good at what they do. So that might be interesting, and you might make the murder someplace different.
Yeah, that's right.
Would
yeah,
they,
I mean,
would they both have to leave their
of,
comfort zone? That would be really nice.
That's right. And again, I never thought of it, but it's a good idea.
Sometimes I come up with better ideas for other people than I do for myself. What I say. So why did Adele Hartman not divorce her husband? Because she hated him and she was afraid of him. So why didn't she just skedaddle before he killed her?
Because she was dependent upon him. She didn't work. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the provider. She had a family with him. I think, don't you think, Fran, I mean, you've been around, don't you think a lot of women stay in bad marriages,
yeah.
as maybe men do too, because A, of inertia, and B, fear, and, you know, what's going to happen to me, you know, things may be bad now, but they'll be a lot worse if there's not someone around. So I think that's very common, don't you? I mean, it's not
unfortunately, it is, but I was lucky in a sense that my mother taught me at 4 years old, that you're going to be independent, be able to take care of yourself and depend on no one. And I guess maybe it stuck with me becoming an educator and getting all my master's degrees and being able to take care of myself, because when a situation didn't work out, I was able to take care of myself, because my father had passed away and my mother needed me, my brother, myself, and my sister to take care of her. So for those young people out there, yeah, people fall into bad marriages and then they figure, well, he supports me. What am I going to do? You should be able to take care of yourself. Independence is the is the best remedy for everything. And I know it's what I try to teach. Yeah.
I agree, but in this case, this woman didn't have that independence, didn't have that ability to, especially with three kids, and she didn't have that ability to cut the cord and say, I'm going to go off on my own. And again, I think that's all too common. I think that you're very lucky to have a mother like that who did teach that kind of a lesson.
Not only did she teach the lesson, but if this girl didn't get 100 on a test, she had to write it over and got grounded. My mom never raised her voice and never yelled. She was 5'12" and blonde, and she was so adorable. And if Ruthie spoke, even my father, who was 400 pounds and 6'2", okay. She just had to say it. It was amazing. And the three of us, my sister, my brother, and I mean, I think that's why my nephews are so good. They're so well-behaved because my brother's just like her, poor things. But what about this man growing up? What about his childhood and his education? And why does he feel he was reborn again and could leave his past behind?
Well, my character, I conceived of him as very smart and very sensitive.
Yeah.
Wrong-headed, but smart and sensitive and not a happy childhood, you know, an unhappy childhood, and just tried hard to make it, but couldn't. There are some people who just don't fit in the world, and I think that he was one of them. And I didn't want to write a character that was pure evil. That's not interesting to me. Characters who are very complex, who have evil in them and good in them and meaning well and not so meaning well, those are the kind of characters that are interesting to me, not caricatures. So the one thing I didn't want to do was make a villain, create a villain. He does villainous things, but I wanted everyone to be able to identify in part with him. You know, we've all had that sense of failure. We've all had that sense of frustration. Mm-hmm. We don't do the kind of things he did. But I just think that we all have seeds of everything in us.
Well, this would make a great made-for-TV movie, seriously.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, Fran, because it's just being optioned by a woman who wants to write it as a 12-part TV series. You're sort of prescient. I don't know if she'll sell it, but that's what she wants to do. She wants to make a limited TV series out of it.
Well, look at Tess Gerritsen in Rizzoli and Isles, and her books are phenomenal. And she's coming on March 20th, people. Haha, we're going to just talk in general.
That's great.
Yeah, she's done
quite a few
interviews with me, so is the whole world. But this would make a great Lifetime movie or HBO special.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, and since you have so many different characters and so many different chapters, each chapter or every two chapters could be a series, could be, you know, one episode. That's just
that's exactly the way she sees it, which is fine. I'm not going to have anything to do with it, but that's exactly the way she sees it. As you know, there are so many strong characters that each episode could have, as you say, two or three of the characters in them.
Yeah, but what happens sometimes with that, as Tess told me, is that they take the character, they take the book, and then they present it their way. She said, well, if you look at Rizzoli and Isles, Jane Rizzoli does not look like Angie Harmon. And Moira Isles does not look like the girl that plays her. Definitely not, because I've read all of her books. Mm-hmm. And the characters are totally, totally opposite of what they really are. And she says that they take, you know, the story ideas, and it's based on her characters, but it's not anything she wrote. They write it their way. So I would hate to see them ruin this.
I think it's a mistake for a writer, though, of a novel to try to control TV or movies, only because, you know, I created a book, a novel. If they want to create something different for a movie or a TV show or whatever, fine, you know, it's not my work. It's based on my characters, and it's a different medium. And so I understand that kind of thing. And I think that you have to not have the ego to say it's got to be exactly like my book. It can't be exactly like my book.
No, she didn't. It's just that her books are so good, and so well written, and the plots were so great, and they changed, you know, so much of it that I said it just was something. I mean, it's one of the top shows on television, and
yes.
I was all Leah Niles. It's great. And what Tess does is that she's has her computer, and she comes on at the end or something, and she, you know, they show her answering questions back and forth because she has to be online live to answer questions about it. About, you know, about the episode or what they want to know. But still, her books are so great. It's just a pity to change it. Whereas Iris Johansson's book was on, and she said it was exactly the way she wrote it. So I guess...
That's good. I don't think that's very tough.
Oh, she's tough. She's good. So who was Soleil, and what was her relationship with John, with the killer?
Who is this that you're asking about?
Soleil.
Oh, so that, yes, she was a, she's a one-time character.
Yeah.
And she's a prostitute down south that he runs into. And one of the things I wanted to show in terms of the character is that he, I don't know if it's a conscience or not, but he knows he's done wrong. And in a way, he gets himself in situations throughout the book that are dangerous and self-destructive. And one of the situations that he does is try to hook up with a prostitute. And so, you know, as I said, she has a short chapter, and it's just about her take on Hartman, who he is and what kind of person he is.
Well, there's a whole bunch of other characters that you talk about. Chapter 13, Floyd describes how he feels about. And there are other voices. There's Christopher Jackson, Jerry Kovacs, Joseph Schiltz, Judy Hartman Swanson, that's his sister, right, and many more. Who are they? What role did they play in the life of the killer?
They all play some role, some of them in his past and some of them in his present in terms of where he's going and how he deals with the aftermath of what he's done. And the interesting thing for me as a writer was, and it happens to be the way I write, is none of those characters were planned. I would sit down at the computer and I'd say, okay, this is where he's going to be next. Who would he be most likely to run into?
Yeah.
And why? And then I would create the character. So those characters were not really planned as much as they came out of my head just in trying to imagine where Hartman would be at that point.
Wow. That's what I was wondering, how you chose each of the things. So why did it take so long to get them?
Why did it take so long to what? To
get them.
You know, because I wanted this to stretch out over a long period of time because I just saw it that way, that I didn't want a quick solution to it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that this guy is going to ramble for months and maybe years before something happens. And I won't give away the ending because you've already touted it. It's kind of interesting. But I wanted it to be a long period, but I also wanted to show how obsessed Floyd is with the case, that he would stay on it for that long, that it wouldn't disappear from his mind.
Well, it sort of ruined his personal life too, didn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he was married, right? And it's sort of like it ruined his relationship with anything. But he was so into his job. I wonder, in real life, I guess if this killer were really out there, well, he was really out there. That if there are police officers like that in real life, that would, you know, just give it all up just to get somebody. Because I've read 2,000 books, and I've seen where they said police find the person that they think did the murder, and they don't look any further.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as they go. Yeah, and they're not even sure if he's the right person. But the police commissioner might say, okay, let's arrest this guy so that we can get, you know, the public will be happy, nobody's going to yell, but they don't look any further, maybe the guy's innocent. But in this particular case, they were sure. But yet they weren't sure. They couldn't find him.
Right. But in your business too, friend, don't you find that there are some people who take their jobs really seriously and will go for a mile? That's the way I saw him.
That's exactly why I liked him, because I guess it's a work ethic my father taught me. He said, if you're going to do something right, you do it. If you don't want to do it, don't do it at all. And I guess for all my life I was an educator. And when I had to retire, it was sad because my mom got sick. And if I could still, you know, do it, I would. So I help with homework. My nieces and nieces in college, and, yeah, they call me to help them with their essays and stuff, and we talk about it, which is great. So when I decided to become a book reviewer and to do radio and everything else, I was like, oh, my God, you have to, and I don't get paid, people. I do it because I like doing it, and I do it because I feel responsible to the authors. I'm going to just let Carol on and say hello real fast and ask some more questions. Hi, Carol.
Okay. Hi there.
Hi. Charles Schalzberg is here. I'll be done. We're going to be finished in just a moment, and I'm glad you're here. And this is going to be a very powerful show, people. Okay, so we talked before that Hartman didn't recognize himself when he was in Miami. So how did, and the case impacted the person that was after him. Knowing the outcome of the story, and we keep readers in suspense, we were talking just now, where would you place Floyd next? Where would you place him next? We're not going to tell
you mean after the case?
After this particular case is over, we're not going to tell anybody what happens at the end. Mm-hmm. So, and we know that the neighbor is still trying to, you know, get involved. Where would you place this investigator?
I think that he quits his job as investigator and either changes professions or goes private or something like that. That's the way I would see him after this case. I don't think he would continue working for the state.
So what's next for you? What's your next book that I'm going to get?
Well, I have a detective series. The first one was called Swan's Last Song, and it was surprisingly nominated for a Seamus Award. And then the sequel, Swan Dives In, and then the third in the series is coming out in October, and it's called Swan's Lake of Despair. And this series is kind of interesting because there are no murders in this. Even though it's a detective novel, the crimes are never murder, at least so far.
That's going to be so interesting. So how can everybody learn more about you?
They can go to my website, charlessalzberg.com.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think everything about me is up there.
Well,
and
If you want to send me the first two books in the series and don't mind waiting forever for the reviews, please send them to me.
I will.
Fran's got 42 books to read, seriously.
There's no rush, and I'm going to send them. I will promise to send you both, Fran. I'll email you for your address.
Thank you. And thank you so very, very, very much. And I am going to be, let me just announce next week, Joshua Graham, the number one author on Barnes & Noble. Thriller is going to be here with Beyond Justice. What would you do if somebody killed your family? Would you be able to say, I forgive you? Mark Rubenstein will be here with Foot Soldier. We're going to talk about real-life incidents in the Vietnam War, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the week after, the man that wrote Mandiba, The 26 Faces of Nelson Mandela, Danny Schechter, will be there. And the following week, Fran's taking off.
And thank you so much, Fran. It was fun.
Thank you so much. And if I decide to do a Mystery Thursday, which I do, might do it March or April, I will let you know where we have a whole bunch of authors and we talk about how we create our characters in mystery. And you never know what can happen. Thank you so much.
I'd love to. Thank you, Fran. Bye.
Bye. Carol, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And you?
I'm tired. Doing okay.
I bet you are.
I'm going to take a one-minute break, and I'll be right back. I'm just going to get 1 minute break, and then we're going to start your interview. Okay? Give me 1 second.
Okay, that sounds good.
I'm taking 1 minute to go to the bathroom, so I'm driving here.
I just had to put some water on my eyes.
Okay. wake up.
No, it's just my eyes start to bug out after looking at my computer. I try not to look at my computer.
Oh, yes.
This book of yours is called The Unvarnished Truth About the Prison Family Journey. And I've told about 50 people about this book, seriously. I even told
the cab driver
about it that took me to a medical appointment on Tuesday. He was totally, he thinks, he said, oh, my God, you're so interesting. But this book is really, you know, turned you out of head. When I read it and I read what Philip wrote and then I read what you wrote, I had a box of tissues. I don't think people realize what really goes on. And the sad part is that innocent people are ostracized. So before I ask the questions on my paper, what made you decide to write this, and how did you get the prison officials to allow him to write what he wrote? Because it was straightforward and honest.
Hmm. Yes, he was very, very direct and very honest. Well, for my part, I have worked as a social worker in the field of criminal justice for, I hate to say it, but over 30 years. And and over that time, I've seen how we as counselors work so hard with people, children and adults that are incarcerated, to help them to change their way of thinking, their way of acting, et cetera. But during that period of time, and it doesn't matter how many years it is, they make a great deal of change, a great deal of progress, but they have to go back into a family that is going to operate the same way it did before because no one has reached out to that family. Prison families live pretty much in isolation. They withdraw from the mainstream community, and they get no help, and they don't know how necessarily, I don't want to say all of them, but most of them don't know how to reach out for help. Mm. And I just thought, you know, we need to speak to these people. We need to empower them. We need to help them to be more functional as families when their loved one returns from prison, because 95% of people are coming back home from prison, and we need to understand that and support their entire family. As far as Philip's point of view, I've known Philip since he was 14 years old. He's now 37 and incarcerated for 14 years now. We're actually, and I'm going to put a plug in for this, because we're actually doing a clemency packet for him, because some of your listeners won't know this, but our criminal, pardon?
I'm glad. That is good.
Oh, yes, because he has a 60-year sentence, which is a very unjustly gotten and exceedingly excessive sentence for the situation that they sentenced him for. But many of your listeners won't know that until they're tangled up in the web of the justice system, the justice system isn't always just. And my own family has run into a few things. Even just a few months ago, my son was arrested, and I spent the night in jail. And a few days later, the police threw the case out. Because the video showed that the police officer was wrong, not him, not my son. And that happens all over the country far too many times. But as I said, Philip is incarcerated in a Texas prison, and he didn't ask for permission to do that. Our prisoners do still have some freedoms, I guess you could say. And if they want to write, and about their situation and their circumstances, they can. And as it was, we sent this back and forth in the mail, and they do review every single piece of mail that goes into any prison system. And so they read it while we were writing it. And we would, send back and forth our corrections and our suggestions to one another. So he wrote it because he too believes that the family needs to be strengthened during the prisoner's incarceration. And so he says that if we don't speak out about these things that happen, they will never change. They will stay the same. So he's a very bold and courageous young man, and I applaud him for that. So I appreciated his participating in writing this book.
Do you think he's ever going to get out?
I believe that this clemency, yes. In fact, I'll send you as much information as I can. It's 100 pages, the clemency packet is, because of the many errors that were made in his case. And they weren't just errors. They withheld information. And when you withhold information, very often you don't get the whole story, so you're making decisions based on half-truths. And then when the judge sentenced him to 60 years, it was astounding because he had been offered in a plea bargain probation. And so it's been 14 long years, and we believe that actually the judge that sentenced him was ousted in the next election because of the corruption, because he had done some very wrong things. There's a case, even people can Google it on the Internet. The man's name is Tyrone Brown, and he was eventually given a pardon by our governor because of the corruption in his case. So both the district attorney and the judge were ousted at the next election. So none of the old people are still in office. There's a new district attorney, new judge, and a new police chief even, since Philip was incarcerated. So we're very hopeful that we just now are starting to send out letters of support, and I'm going to be taking the clemency packets to Dallas to distribute to these people when I go there for our prisoners' family conference, which we'll have to talk about too, toward the end of the month.
So how would anybody know that the district attorney or somebody withheld information? The lawyer that worked with him, I mean, I read in the book that you said not to take a plea bargain, you know, to say that you're innocent. And that in this particular case, what would have happened if he agreed and he wouldn't have gone to jail then, in other words?
He did agree to the plea bargain.
He did agree.
Sometimes I feel really bad about saying the things that I say about the criminal justice system, because we need a criminal justice system, and I want everybody to know that I understand that. We need to be safe out here in our communities, and there are people who do very bad things. Mm-hmm. Philip even tells me some of these people need to be in here, and they do, because they can't operate and function safely in our society.
Yep.
But today, the majority of our prisoners are nonviolent offenders. 80% of prisoners today are nonviolent offenders. Most of them are substance abuse offenders, drug offenders, and they've done nothing but hurt themselves, really. And maybe, you know, their family obviously is hurting because they're in there. But the plea bargain issue, which you mentioned, is a very sensitive subject. The plea bargain is in place solely for the courts.
Yeah.
If every case went to trial, if every case that's before the courts today went to trial, literally our courts would crash. They have no capacity to handle the amount of litigation that goes before them. So they established the plea bargain really for their sake. The plea bargain speeds up everything. It clears their docket. It's much cheaper for the courts.
Mm-hmm.
Let me not take that back. That's a little exaggeration. It rarely ever benefits the defendant. They quickly want this thing to be over with. They want a conviction. And when you plea bargain, you are admitting guilt.
You're guilty,
and so the minute you sign your name on that paper, it says, I'm guilty of this offense, and I agree to whatever sentence that you've written on this piece of paper. However, the judge does not have to accept it. The judge, he or she, can say, well, I don't agree with this sentence, and I think it should be longer. They could even say it could be shorter, but they rarely do that because they want a conviction and they want to keep our prisons full. Being from the North Country where you are, you may be aware that our prisons are an industry. It's a huge lucrative business in this country.
Yeah.
And in the investors, there's a stock broker in New York that has invested $9 million in one of your New York private prisons. They've invested $9 million expecting to get a return on that.
Mm.
So they have to keep those prisons full and run them as economically, cheaply as possible in order to make a return on their investment. It's a big business. So they have to keep the jails full. They have to keep the prisons full. And they keep people recycling back and forth through the prison system and through probation and parole just to keep the money flowing. It's a business. It's all about money. And it doesn't matter, because when people go into prison, they're not getting rehabilitation. I know that many of our citizens think they are. But there is rarely any form of counseling that goes on in prison. If people change in prison, it's because they choose to change. It's because they have people on the outside who are supportive of them and encouraging to them.
Mm-hmm.
They may have ministries that come into the chapel that they hook up with and get some encouragement from. But there is rarely any, there's some, you know, hit and miss in prison systems. There's a counseling program in this state or one in that state, but they're never the same. I have a young man that I correspond with who's in a very special reentry program here in Texas. And I asked him, I said, well, how many of you are in that program? And he said, oh, there are probably 100, maybe 125 of us in this program at any given time. And it's a two-year program, so they stay there 100. We have 160,000 prisoners in Texas. 125 of them get this special program.
What made them choose
them? So the percentages are. Pardon?
What made them choose them? Why those 125 and no one else?
You know, it's a gift from God, that's all I can say, is that he's in that program. He's doing remarkably well in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they choose that lucky 100, 125 people mm-hmm. for one small, teeny tiny program, but that program should be in every prison. If it's doing so much for these people, it should be everywhere. But it's not. It's one little tiny program in a huge, huge ocean of prisoners.
Maybe they don't. Maybe, as you said, because it's money, they don't want to invest so that these people don't get out and there's more of them staying in. They rehabilitate too many,
yes.
Then they won't have all their money.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And as a matter of fact, this is a program that is paid for by community volunteers.
Mm.
The prison operates, they have a building there, and I guess they pay the electricity bill, but they don't pay anything to run the program. People come in from the community to run it. So they're not paying staff, in other words, which is your, you know, pretty mm-hmm. next most high expense as an employer, so other than operating your building. So they probably save money by not having to pay people to run it. And of course, now these people probably, I think they said they had something like a maybe a, I forget what he told me, about a 12% recidivism rate, mm-hmm. which compared to the nation's 65% recidivism rate is pretty remarkable.
Wow.
So it's a it should be happening everywhere. I just received a video to be shown at our conference from New York. As a matter of fact, it's the Bedford Women's Prison,
mm-hmm.
and they have a wonderful program
right
there for
here.
Mothers. Yes, right. And however, in your entire New York system, it's one little tiny program for 15 women. You know, 15 at a time can go through that program. And then when they kind of age out of it and get ready to return to the community, they move into another women's prison, which has nothing for them. So they've gotten all this good stuff for several years. And now they're ready to go home, and there's nothing in the reentry program. So they don't think out what would help these people stay out of prison. It's more like what you just said, is how can we keep them coming back so that we can have the money flowing.
That's what it sounds
yes.
like, and it really is. It's in the way he described it, and the book is described the way these people are treated. I mean, not everybody
mm-hmm.
is a hard-nosed criminal. And to me, to mistreat
right.
them and to treat them as subhuman, well, that's as an educator, whatever. You know something? This book is so powerful that I think that high schools and teens and people taking criminal justice should read this, so maybe some teens will be saved from going to jail. Just reading what he's writing and what you're saying about being isolated from the family after arrested, not being able to communicate, and all the things that happen to them before they even can get a lawyer, before they're even, you know, heard or their case is heard, is scary.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if a teenager read what you wrote and understood what was going to happen to them and read what Philip wrote, maybe some of these
mm-hmm.
kids would think twice before they do something horrible.
We would hope, certainly.
We would hope, but I
don't
know.
Well, and we would very much like to see the book in criminal justice classes and counseling classes.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
People in education classes, and because 1 in 7 children in our United States classrooms has a parent either in prison or on probation or parole. That's a lot of children are being affected by the incarceration. We call it mass incarceration today. We actually have a group that is called End Mass Incarceration. It's a movement across the nation now. We've got chapters in different states to end all of these things that are fueling mass incarceration in our country, including the drug war, which is incarcerating 85% of our prisoners. We would save a lot of money if we would close down our prisons. They're not necessary. It's better to put that money in substance abuse programs. But we would very much like to see this book take off. After the conference at the end of February, mm-hmm. I'm going to be promoting the book a lot more than we've been able to do it now. And we do hope to get it in colleges and universities, high school classes. It would be wonderful if they would read that and understand that prison is not a glamorous place to be. Too many young people do glamorize, you know, the tough guy, the gangster. It's cool. It's not cool at all. It's a very miserable and sad and lonely place. You have no friends in prison. You have acquaintances and associates, people
they're
that you
friends.
Kind of you might. You know, right, but there's no one you can trust. And so you're 24 hours a day on guard that someone can turn on you in just a minute. I hear that from Philip quite often, is that people that he, you know, played in, he's a very talented musician, and he was heading up the chapel music group, orchestra, whatever they called themselves. And obviously I'm not musically inclined, you can see, but he is extremely talented, and he was the head of their music group that they had in there. Constant bickering, and then they would be nice to each other for a little while. Then they get jealous of each other. And you live with this constantly, never knowing how they're going to feel about you tomorrow, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's a miserable way to live. Yes, and without outside support
and people that think that
no,
there's drugs in prison too, right? And gangs and all
yes,
of that.
Exactly, and in fact, prisoners will tell you that anything you can find in the free world, you can find in prison. So there's drugs, there's sex, there's violence, there's good things too. I mean, they have moments of, you know, laughing together and joking and stuff, but that's very rare. It's, you know, compared to the miserable things. And of course, the gangs are rampant in prisons. Many people join the gangs to feel protected, but the gang
not
can
really
turn on you within a second, you know. And so it's very dangerous to become involved with a gang. It's better to try to go it on your own and, you know, kind of fight your way through the mess that's in there.
Well, they're sort of teaching kids that if there's gangs in prison and the guards are turning their heads and the warden doesn't really care, then they're telling them, well, you know,
right.
then it's okay. So these kids on the outside that join gangs think that they're going to join and be tough in prison and they're going to join another gang, and
mm-hmm.
slowly but surely they will wind up dead. I mean, this is
exactly.
like...
Exactly.
It's scary. I mean, gang violence. I mean, I taught in a New York City public school, and I was the dean, and I'm little, 109 pounds of little.
Yeah.
And I walked into
Ooh,
a room,
yes.
and everybody got like, oh, my God, she's here. What is she going to do? And I didn't have
mm-hmm.
to really raise my voice. It was just I was lucky, my tone and my 3 cell phones. One for mother, one for father, one for the office, just in case I got upset. I had 3 different cell phones in my hand. You never, and I mean,
yes.
and the kids were huge. I'm little, and the kids in the 6th grade were like 9 feet tall, I would tell them. And as a dean, it was scary because I was told I had to break up fights. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I was told that I was allowed to break up fights. Now, this is a public school in New York, and, you know, you don't want to touch a child. You don't want to get accused. But part of my job description is if two kids got into a fight, I had to literally tell them, okay, you need to stop. But if they didn't stop, I had to find a way to physically stop them. Now, there were several teachers in my school that were black belt in karate. They taught me different ways to stop a fight without getting hurt. And I think part was I said, and there were never gangs in my school. But what happened was my principal, the new one, she was, I don't know why, she said to me, you've been here for 30-some-odd years. I started when I was 12, I think. I was really young. And she said, why do you care? I go, what do you mean, why do I care? I said, I love these kids. They're amazing. They're smart. They're terrific.
Yes.
And I was still teaching a writing and reading group. I said, my job is to protect the children. My job is to make the teacher's job easier so that you don't get them. I'll take care of it. And I handled everything for the first 6 months. And she says to me, you need to let the teachers handle it, you know, see what happens. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll go you one better. In all the years I was teaching, I never took a day, more than a day off, a whole year. I took a week.
Oh, my goodness.
When I came back,
goodness.
All you-know-what broke loose.
Yeah.
And she had, they had admitted,
I bet.
They had admitted a child that was 14 in the sixth grade. Somebody made a mistake. And he was dangerous. I mean, really dangerous.
Yeah.
He had drugs, he had weapons, he had everything. And this was something that was a tough school, but we didn't have it. And he formed his own posse, and I made sure I broke it up in my own little way. And for whatever reason, this young man didn't want me to be mad at him. And every time he got in trouble, he didn't want me to be mad at him. But when his mother came in with a marijuana leaf on her T-shirt, I knew we were in big trouble here.
Absolutely.
She was afraid of him.
Yes,
I wasn't afraid. I refused to be afraid, but I learned. I mean, two big sixth-grade boys came up to my office, and they were going at it. I took one knee on one side and one knee on the other side, and I go, I dare you to want to sing soprano. I don't think you want to do it. And they looked at me and go, no, give up. I was hysterical.
Yes.
I knew either laugh or cry. And, of course, I hurt my arm because they were they were like 200 pounds. And at that point, it was before I lost all my weight. So I was like about 160, 170, now I'm 109. And I'm going like, I'm not that much smaller than you. I may be wider. And I couldn't believe that I wouldn't back down. I mean, then there was situations where I said to her, I don't want to hurt anybody, you know, me, and I don't want to get hurt. And, I took the job for a year. They wanted me to have it another year. And I was saying, like, the parents would come in and they would say, we understand you're allowed to do that. Whereas when I asked one of the male teachers who is 9 feet tall to help me out and do something, she said, you can break up a fight, he can't. And he was a minority. He was minority. And and he was very nice. He would never, hurt anybody.
Yeah.
She says, you can do whatever you want because you are the dean and we love you. Okay, so whatever.
Well, that's very nice. So
yeah,
you must
have
been wonderful with the kids. Well, that's interesting that you were able to break up fights in a school, because in prison the officers do not no one on the administration level on the officers level will interfere with a fight. If the inmates begin to fight, if they stab one another, if they kill one another, the officers don't go in, and
that's horrible.
Because they let the inmates run the prison. And after it's over with, the inmates also are the ones that clean up the mess. They clean up the blood and the gore, and they take the person to the infirmary. An officer might escort them. But you see pictures every once in a while of a SWAT team kind of thing going into a cell to pick up somebody. Sometimes when they have mentally ill prisoners, that's how they treat them. They treat them with brutality, and they send in, for one prisoner, they send in 10 guards in SWAT uniforms with all the apparatus, and they tear gas them and that sort of thing. But their job is to keep the public safe from the inmates.
It is
not to keep the inmates safe from one another. And so the inmates have no protection, only themselves to rely on, which is really scary to families because families know that their loved one is living in a very dangerous environment at all times. And it is scary. I hear these stories all the time from the guys that are in prison, from women who are in prison. It's very violent for the women too. So it's interesting to me that you were allowed to separate two people that were fighting two students.
Yeah. I was told that I was supposed to do it, and I'm looking at her going, you have to be kidding me. In this day and age with what goes on, to be allowed and told if I didn't try to break up the fight, and most of the time I was able to just say knock it off. And it was rare that I had to actually step in. And I would say, don't make me get in the middle of you, because if I get hurt and break a nail, you're going to be in trouble. And they would look at me and they would go, break a nail. I said, if I break a nail and it hurts me, you're getting suspended for breaking my nail. That's it. And they didn't want to get...
Well, it's pretty amazing that our titles give us a lot of power. That when they talk about the warden in the prison, they don't do anything in front of the warden. You know, the officers, yes. But in the warden's coming, and it's like you being the dean of the school, It's like nothing is going to happen in front of you. We want you on our side. And it's our titles that do that. It's amazing how much power we have in our titles.
So that's
great. Yes.
It was, and it was respect. But I, my mother said to me, my mother passed away right after. She said to me, I don't really want you to do this for another year. You're becoming, they call me Rambo. And my sister worked for orthopedic surgeon, and she passed away 2 years ago. And I would come into the office, and they would have the arm brace for me, and the X-ray machine ready, because the kids didn't hurt me. It's just that I pulled muscle in something, breaking up fights. And
what
finally,
happened?
I
yes.
said to my principal,
right.
I said to her, you know what? I'm going to send you the bill, because this is getting.
Well,
I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
It gets crazy. So how do you prepare, a child's father is in jail. I mean, I've had that with kids in my school.
Uh-huh.
Parents are in jail, and it's sad, so we talk about it. The guidance counselors in my school when I worked there were fantastic, so they understood.
Mm-hmm.
How do you prepare a child that his father is in jail, it's not their fault, and the best thing they could do is succeed in school? It's hard. And it takes its toll on the kids. So how do you make them?
Exactly.
I mean, do you go into schools
you
and
can't
talk
make
to the kids?
Them,
you can't make, but you can only hope.
Right. You can't make them do anything. But, yes, the children are very traumatized by having a parent or even a close relative, a brother or an uncle, an aunt in prison. And you can do, of course, counseling with them is a very important thing, and I think it does help for many of the young people. But the fact is they need each other. What we found here, we have a program that brought children together under one roof, and they could talk to each other openly about it. When a loved one goes to prison, the family feels the shame and the embarrassment of having someone in prison. There's still such a stigma attached to that, and the children feel that too. They know that children get in trouble, not parents. And so when a parent goes to prison, and we'll just use a parent as the relative in this case, they're embarrassed by it because they know their father or mother did something really wrong, and they're shamed by it. So they shut up, they withdraw from the entire community, the whole family really does, and they have no outlet for it. And when we don't have any outlet for our emotions, we act it out, and all of us do that. If we have no one to tell about our problems, we're going to overeat or overdrink or, we're going to do something to ease that kind of pain. For kids, they act out either violently, they'll join gangs where they feel that they belong. And the minute that they realize that substances will give them some ease from their pain, they'll start using drugs and alcohol. And so it's very important to allow them opportunities to talk with other children who have had the same experience. I remember one of the first kids that we worked with, his mother just got our brochure. Actually, a judge gave her the brochure. And it just said, children are prisoners, I think, on the front of it. And when she handed it to him, he was 11 years old, and she just let him read it. She said he looked at her, and he said, do you mean other children have parents in prison? Because they feel so alone. They feel that they have no one that they can share their pain with. So bringing children together in group activities and not necessarily mm-hmm. even counseling activities. We would do picnics with them. We did a five-day summer camp with them. And you hear me talking in past tense because we lost all of our grant funding and we don't have program anymore. I still get referrals all the time. I had one yesterday, and I have to say I'm sorry, but our funding is gone. The federal grants dried up 8 years ago, or however many years ago that was, when the new regime came in, and they were trying to balance the budget with children of all kinds of children. They took away money from a lot of different children's programs, and children of prisoners were amongst them. So agencies like ours have either closed or they've kind of regrouped, and now we do a lot more advocacy on behalf of families because it can be done by volunteers, and we don't need so many staff as we did when we were working with the children. However, the children need that support. We did a Christmas reunion because we wanted the children to be able to see that they're still out there. A lot of them have just shared phone numbers and such that were in the program, so they do call each other and support each other. But I had a young girl right around Christmas time, as a matter of fact, that called me. She's in her 20s now, but she was in our program from the time she was about 12 or 13. And stayed in it all the way till she graduated from high school. And she is really an overachiever, just a wonderful young lady. But she called, well, actually we're friends on Facebook. And one night she messaged me, and in our conversation I asked how things were going. Her mother had come back from prison about 3 years before. So I knew that Mom was supposed to be at home. So I asked how she was doing. And then everything kind of broke loose. His mother was back in prison. She had gone back to selling drugs and using drugs. And the young lady, who's now, I said, in her early 20s, felt very guilty about that. She felt responsible for it. So I actually invited her over to my home, since we have no office anymore, unfortunately. And we talked about this, is that she saw that the mother was really struggling to make a living, and struggling to make a life out here in the community. There is no support for people coming back from prison virtually, very little support. It's very hard for them to get a job. There's no housing unless your family has housing, and I mean their own personal. They can't rent. Felons cannot rent houses, you know, any kind of apartments and that sort of thing. So here's a mother that's really struggling. She was selling Mary Kay, and she was selling Tupperware, and she was doing what she could, making tacos, selling them on the street. And the girl told her, you know, I see it's so hard for you, Mom. You need to do what you need to do, you know, whatever you think you need to do. The next thing she knew, her mother was selling drugs again and back in prison. And she felt it was her giving her the leeway to do that by just saying to her, do whatever you need to do. Well, of course, it was Mom's choice to do what she did.
Yeah.
She could have kept selling Tupperware and et cetera, but she chose to go with it. And this poor girl, you know, is just feeling the burden of that, even though she's in her 20s now. Her younger brother has acted out in angry ways. He gets violent sometimes. He's extremely obese. And that's part of the way that he acts out, by the overeating. His pain and suffering at the mother never being there for them. So these children really suffer, and they really, really need support. They need support from their loved one in prison, even while they're in prison. Some of them are too angry to accept it, and you have to work with them to help them to, you know, to be able to let go of that anger. I heard you talk about another person that you're going to be having on the show about the forgiveness, and would you be able to forgive somebody who
Next week I'm going to have Joshua Graham, and it's a Christian fiction murder.
But that's a very real issue, fiction or not. It's a very real issue. In fact, we have a woman that's going to be one of the keynote speakers at our Prisoners Family Conference, whose only child, a son, was murdered in a carjacking that went haywire a good number of years ago. And she's started a program. It's a victim offender program where, you know, you prepare to interview the victim, like she is the victim of that crime. Actually, she met with her son's murderer. And she talks about how she really needed to hang on to her anger because she felt it would betray her son if she let go of her anger. And mm-hmm. for years she hung on to this anger until she decided in anger to go meet the murderer. And when they met, all of that fell apart. She realized that he was a human being. He did a horrible, awful thing. But the meeting that they had with one another changed both of their lives. And I often have prayed that, God forbid, that should happen to one of my children, that I would be able to let go of the anger, because that anger controls you. And you're letting that person continue to victimize you.
This book is about that.
And so it's
about
a very important issue.
Yeah, the man goes to prison, and he didn't commit the murder. And they claim that he killed his family because when he came in, they found him covered in blood. And the police never, they never bothered to check or check further. Oh, did he really do it? Or, did someone else do it? Because he was the scapegoat. When all the evidence finally came, blah, 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 and he finally gets out, he becomes friends with this pastor and his people, and they take him in, and they're kind to him, and the community shuns him. He can't get a job, blah, blah, blah. The pastor gives him a job as a janitor. And he tries to get back his, whatever little semblance of life that he can get. And the main thing is that he meets the man that killed his family, and they want to know if he could possibly forgive him. Yeah, and there's a lot of scriptures.
This is a very real story.
It's very real.
And even though he wrote it as a fiction, it's very real, and it happens all the time. And too many people can't forgive, and they allow that to control their lives for the rest of their life, or however long they want to hold on to that anger. And so that's a very important thing. And you mentioned the innocence issue is that we have national innocence projects, for anybody who doesn't know that, and they're in many states. They're not in all states. Often they're run by colleges or universities in the law schools departments. And they find that at least 5% of today's prisoners are innocent. Now, we see people being exonerated constantly. So, and you mentioned earlier, is that they're treated with the same disdain and disrespect and inhumanity as all prisoners. They go through the nightmare of being in prison. And innocent, can you imagine? It's being like buried alive in a coffin because there's nothing you can do to get out. And nobody wants to believe you. There's, this stereotyping of all prisoners say that they're innocent. Well, that's not true. I know almost everybody I know is guilty, and they say they're guilty. And so it's not true that everybody says, that everybody is saying they're innocent. There are actually innocent people. The National Innocence Projects tell us that if only 1% of today's prisoners were innocent, that would be 20,000 people. So now you look at 5%. Mm. So that's 100,000 people in our prisons today who actually had nothing to do, and we have actually executed innocent people. They just exonerated someone who died back in the 80s, I think they executed this man. And they now know, because of DNA evidence that they didn't have back then, that this man was not guilty of that crime. And it's horrible to think that we're killing people in the name of justice and they're not even guilty. Obviously, I have strong feelings about that.
Well, a lot of times a prisoner, if somebody's arrested and they don't go further to find out whether the person is guilty or not, they don't even care. I wonder what would happen if this came to the media, to the Today Show or a good reporter, if somebody actually interviewed you to talk about this, to bring it to light. Because the sad part is, there are so many people out there that are innocent. If Philip were on this program, and it's really sad that they wouldn't let him have his voice heard, what would he say?
Yes. But
what would his message be to people? I mean, I'm looking at this, what he said about the cost of using the infirmary, the cost of meals, the trust funds, that they have to pay for everything. I don't think people even realize that. You know, medical care, they they don't even get a toothbrush.
Right, exactly. They don't get a toothbrush. I can't say what Philip would say because I think there's a lot of audiences to speak to. I mean, of course, the children, and I know his nephew's gotten in trouble since he's been in prison, and since Philip's been in prison, and I know what he had to say about this is not the place where you want to be. You know, this is a horrible, awful place. Yeah. And when you talk about the how it affects the family, even financially, first of all, you're dealing with all these legal costs, which are exorbitant. It's outrageous. An attorney won't even talk to you until you plunk over $25,000.
That's
right. And it's ridiculous. So if you're not indigent, the family's forking over money. Then you get into the prison, and the public believes that every care is taken care of. They have not a worry in the world. But that's not true. The prisons do not provide anything but bare necessities. There's a roof over their head because that's how prisons are built. There's a metal cot to sleep on and threadbare sheets to put over yourself. Philip called me this morning, as a matter of fact, and last night their electricity went out in North Texas. If you all watched the news today, North Texas had a nice blizzard last night, and so it was freezing in there, and they have no way to keep themselves warm. The clothes that they put on them, their uniforms are usually threadbare. It's very sad. And there's nothing you can do as a family member, as someone who cares, because what can I do other than call and say their electricity's out? What can I do?
You can't send them any clothes. They don't nothing?
No. Now, there are some states that do allow families to send in clothes. Our prisons in Texas make their own clothes. They have a factory that our prisoners here run every aspect of the prison possible. They order the food. They have do the inventory. They stock. They can. They grow the food, and they can it and sell it to grocery stores and keep track of the money and the bookkeeping. And they do every single bit of operating the prisons, and they are paid nothing, absolutely zero, for doing that. It's fine. They're supposed to keep their place clean and keep the, you know, thing up. I understand that. But every aspect of the prison is run by the inmates. And our administrators only oversee, we don't know what they're overseeing exactly, but they're overseeing something. You mentioned the commissary and the infirmary. A couple years ago, our legislator in Texas passed a bill that our prisoners have to pay $100 a year. Now, to some of us out here, that may not sound like much, $100 a year, to use the infirmary.
Oh, my God.
So if they have chronic illnesses, they have to use it. If they have diabetes or heart disease, et cetera, they have to use the infirmary. They are stuck with the $100 bill. Many of those people are forgoing any medical care. They're not taking insulin. They're not getting their heart medicine.
That's horrible.
Because they can't afford the $100. But if anybody's going to pay the $100, it's going to be the family. If they can't pay the $100 and they used the infirmary, they bill them. So if, say, they stayed in prison 10 years and they've used the infirmary for 10 years, when they walk out of prison, they're already $1,000 in the hole.
Because that bill will
be sent to them, and they have to pay it, or they'll go back to prison. And that's what they call justice in our state, anyhow. And I don't think that was our original idea. I think that happens in other states too. The commissary is fine. You know, they get to order snacks and that sort of thing. But they also get toothpaste, which the prison doesn't provide them. They get deodorant, which they don't provide them. They don't provide them the general hygiene things. I hate to even mention this, but for women, the women's prison. They will provide a woman with three pads and five tampons during the entire cycle.
Oh, my God.
Is that gross? And if they want
gross.
Any more, of course, they have to buy them. Yes, it is gross. And some people can't afford to buy them. So, yes, we have a woman that's in a group that I I'm supposed to be the president of, I always hate to say that, but the CURE organization, which is Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, an old organization for prison reform, but we're in this organization together, and she spent 5 years in a women's prison here in Texas, and she brought out exactly what they're given each month in terms of soap. They're given a bar of soap that is smaller than any hotel, motel soap you've ever seen. It's maybe 1 inch square and maybe a quarter of an inch thick.
Oh, my God.
They're given that bar of soap. That's the bar of soap that they give them. So if they want soap, they have to buy it. They're given a piece of, it looks like almost like wax paper that has tooth powder sprinkled in the wax paper, and then it's folded over. So that would be what their toothpaste is supposed to be. They're given the head of a toothbrush, and that's because of safety reasons. So none of them actually get toothbrushes, period. And so a head of a toothbrush and this little minimal amount of tooth powder in a piece of paper is all that they give them.
And they must have a lot of tooth decay and a lot of people losing teeth and a lot of...
Yes, they have rotten teeth.
A lot of gingivitis and stuff, yeah.
Exactly, because the diet is so pathetic in prisons. I just had a woman who called me the other day whose husband is in prison in Colorado. He had scurvy, and he's lost all of his teeth, and they refuse to give him any kind of dental care. What they do in prison is when you, and this is across the board, I think, is when they have a toothache or a tooth problem, they just pull their teeth. They don't bother to fix
That's
anything.
Wrong. That's wrong.
And she threatened to sue the state if he didn't at least get dentures so he could eat, because he was, you know, literally starving to death. That's why he had
she
the scurvy.
She should definitely go. I'm telling you, this needs to be brought out to the media, because that's scary. I mean, forget about it.
I wish
it.
We could. The media is not too interested, because prison is not a popular subject to sell.
Well,
if
you're selling it to save kids. And to tell them
well,
that
the kids
this is what's
part,
happening.
Children of prisoners, yes. We were able to do a little bit with children of prisoners, but not that much. There's a very few reporters who are willing to risk their necks and their jobs to look into things and to fight the state and fight the federal government, because we have federal prisons too, remember. And they're all run pretty much the same. It doesn't, you know, people talk about the federal prisons being a country club of prisons. Well, they're not. They're just like any other prison. They have gang members. They have violence. You know, they may look a little cleaner. I don't know. You know, the few I've been in have been a little cleaner, and it seems like they may train their staff a little bit better than the state prisons. But that's about it. There's no distinction.
What about pictures? Nobody's gone in with a photographer. Nobody's actually seen. Nobody's ever taken pictures and putting it in the paper. That would be telling, wouldn't it? I mean, that's
it
horrible.
It would be very telling. There have been a few, like, sort of, I wouldn't say contraband, but a few people have kind of gone underground into prisons and have gotten some shots that are just disgusting and appalling and very frightening. But to do an expose, I can tell you that I worked in a juvenile prison in Colorado a number of years ago, and I had come there from our state facilities here in Texas. And I thought I was getting a better job. But when I got to this private facility for juveniles in Colorado, I found them abusing, literally physically abusing these kids. The first day I was there, I walked over 6 piles of men, 3 to 4 men lying on a small child. And sometimes, you know, teenagers can be as big or bigger than we are, of course. But these were just little scrawny kids. And when I went and questioned it, I was chastised for even questioning it, and was told that that's how they break them down to build them up. Well, that's not how we treat children, in my opinion, anyhow. And when I went to report it to Child Protective Services, they informed me something that people need to be aware of. There is no oversight of any criminal justice system, adult or child, anywhere. They're totally autonomous. No one can go in there and do anything about it. Nobody. They wouldn't go in and see these kids. finally, it took 4 years, but we did finally get the media. I left. I walked off the job, to be very honest with you.
I wouldn't do it either.
I couldn't see that.
I wouldn't do it either.
And finally, the Chicago Tribune was very active in really pursuing it. Other ones did too, like 2020 and, you know, Dateline mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But the Chicago Tribune was just, they doggedly went after this. And finally, it took them 4 years, and it was so exposed by then that they did have to close the facility. I went back up to Colorado, and I sat on that empty parking lot in front of that facility thinking I'd have some satisfaction and that finally that they closed this place down. But there was no satisfaction because so much good could have been done for those children by just
right.
providing them good treatment while they were there. And what they had done was to damage many, many hundreds of kids that had gone through that facility until we discovered. I was just appalling. I mean, I can't even. We never did that to the kids when I worked with them here in Texas, although Texas has had its scandals in the juvenile system too, subsequent to my leaving, I have to say. But to get someone that interested, and they got interested kind of like you said, it's about the children.
Yeah.
They'll get interested in the children, but adults, they really care. They broke the law, and so just let them rot in prison. But these are human beings. I'm sorry.
That's the problem.
These are actual people that are in prison, and people need to recognize it. There aren't animals locked in prison, and we wouldn't treat an animal like these human beings are being treated in our prisons. That was another reason for us writing the book, is we wanted people to know that it's there is no country club in the prison. There's no rehabilitation in prisons. Your tax dollars are going to create worse and worse people. Your tax mm-hmm. dollars are going to run prisons that are wasteful. They're wasting billions of dollars, $64 billion a year to run our prison systems in this country. For what? So they can come out and do another crime because they're treated like dirt when they come back home.
We have about 5 minutes.
Yes.
And I want you to be
okay,
able to
sorry.
Tell everybody about the prison conference. And also, have
okay.
you ever thought about putting out a small handbook for people when they come to these meetings, just so they have an idea of what the legal things are and what to expect? Tell everybody about the prison conference that's coming up before we close. We have
okay.
about 5 minutes.
Okay. It's actually the Prisoners Family Conference. It's a national conference, and we'll be having the 6th annual conference February 19th through 21st in Dallas, Texas. We try to move it around a bit so that we can reach more people, but we kind of have to keep it in Texas because we are a nonprofit agency and we don't pay taxes here. So it's a little bit cheaper for us to operate it. But we bring together people who both work in the field of criminal justice, who work in social services,
mm-hmm.
who work in a variety of categories that serve prisoners and their families. But it's also for prison family members to come and feel the love and the support and encouragement of others who have walked the walk. This year we'll be having, for example, one of our keynote speakers' name is Franklin Deese. He wrote a book, Inmate to Mayor. I have to get him to write to you, Fran. And he's just a delight. I've talked to him several times on the phone. He's a mayor of a city of Marshville, North Carolina.
Oh, nice.
And he is a felon. He spent 10 years in prison. And he talks about what it took for him to overcome that. When he got out, he said he wasn't going to let his past control what his future was going to be. We have a young couple, the Tiarinas from Ohio, who are just a wonderful young couple that overcame his 15-year wrongful incarceration. He wasn't guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But it strengthened their family. They used it to strengthen their family, and now they have a program in Ohio called the Ridge Project that helps other families to strengthen themselves when they're going through this horrible ordeal. And then we have seven keynote speakers, but we also have breakout workshops to talk about everything from raising children to prisoners to, how to strengthen your family financially even while you're we have a loved one incarcerated. We have an exhibit area with books and resource materials. We do have some handouts with different resources from around the country from the agencies and organizations that have come to these conferences, ministries as well. So we have both faith-based and secular information for families and for those who work with families of prisoners. And so it's a very intense 3 days. But and in the evenings of Wednesday and Thursday evening, we have advocacy sessions where we work on issues. We actually drafted the first ever Prison Family Bill of Rights at this conference. And we started the en masse incarceration movement at this conference, and we'll be working on the issues that we want to present to our legislators after our en masse incarceration week, which is April 5th through the 18th of this year.
I truly hope you succeed. Really, truly do hope you succeed.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much. I really hope that the clemency works for Philip. I really hope he gets out.
Oh, thank you.
I really do. And you could tell him I said so. And if he ever does come out and you do decide to write another book, I would love to have him on my show.
Well, thank you so much. I will tell him, and that will encourage him so much. Thank you for having
tell
me.
Tell him not to give up. And you know what? It's just too bad that the media doesn't know it. And I thank you so much for coming on my show. And if you decide to write another book or any other information about this, please send it to me.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your support, Fran.
You're welcome.
For having me.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.